Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Alina Scheim of Impact Personal Safety. I'm very happy now to welcome Tom Mossbrooker. He is the artistic director of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, and tomorrow, Friday the 22nd of October at 7:30, there will be an encore performance of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Good morning.
It's great to have you. Now, I have to say, I went to the last performance that you were encoring this time, and it's almost the same program, although there were a couple of George Balanchine pieces that were in the program earlier in the season that are not happening now. But basically, this time around, you've got three contemporary choreographers.
Correct.
Doing stunning works.
Three completely different works, but all contemporary work. Like, as you said, this summer we had two guest dancers from the New York City Ballet because it was our gala evening. And so they won't be with us this performance, but it is the same three mixed repertory pieces.
And so, with three pieces like this, okay, the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet has always guest choreographers. How does it work?
Well, one of our main objectives as a company is to commission new work. And, in fact, this is our 15th anniversary. And in the course of our 14-year existence, we've commissioned 22 ballets. So it's a big part of who we are and what we do. And not only do we commission work, but we try to develop relationships with choreographers and bring them back a second or a third or a fourth time.
And let your audiences see the development of their work.
Exactly, and get to know them as choreographers and see where, like you said, where their work is going. In the case of Nicolò Fonte, who his piece is second on the program, it's called In Hidden Seconds. And that is the seventh work that he did for the company. And coming up later in our 15th anniversary, he'll be doing his eighth work. In the case of Yorma Ello, who's one of the hottest choreographers right now, you can barely pick up the New York Times without reading about him. We got in very early with him before he hit real big in the States, and he's done four works for us.
Where is he from?
From Finland, but he danced for many years in Holland under Yuri Killian. And so it's interesting to see the progression of the work. You and I were talking earlier about the Balanchine work and how contemporary it was when we saw it back in the 60s. And now, in very much the same way as Balanchine did back then, these choreographers are taking the classical ballet form and transforming it into contemporary dance and taking it further and further and further than we ever thought it could go.
I remember I had the great privilege, having grown up outside of New York City in upstate New York and then in Connecticut, of going eight times a year. My beautiful, beloved mother had a subscription to the New York City Ballet, and we got on the train and went down and saw these ballets from the time I was a young teenager on forward. And I remember when I saw it for the first, and I think I saw it three or four times in the course of my life, the Goldberg Variations performed by the New York City Ballet with Jerome Robbins as the choreographer of that, and done to Bach's Goldberg Variations. And it was a revelation at the time, because you had these this abstract music and an abstract ballet and very simple costumes and no sets.
Yeah.
And you had the sort of traditional pas de deux, but then suddenly you had a man carrying a man and a woman dancing with a woman, and all the sort of gender relations were being loosened up and mixed up. And when I went to the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, and that was huge at the time. I mean, it was new and it was so exciting. And when I went to the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet at this performance, which you're encoring tomorrow, I thought, you know, that is no longer a revelation. That is the foundation. That's
exactly.
That's the given on which these choreographers are building now. And on a psychological and sort of societal level, they are dealing with the world in which we live and its complexities through dance in a whole new way.
Yeah, you're so correct, and I'm really happy to know that you got it. A lot of people don't look at it that way, but when you look at what Balanchine was doing, it was absolutely groundbreaking at the time.
And Robbins,
exactly. And now that's what these choreographers are doing, and that's what William Forsythe did. He was tremendously inspired by Balanchine in those years, and he revolutionized dance. And, you know, this is all, you know, it's all a progression, and that's what really what we're interested in, where dance is going and who the next big choreographer is going to be.
I was thinking about your dancers who are the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet dancers are fantastic, and how they're trained in their craft. Because, of course, in the old days, you had kind of the Russian tradition coming down with very strict ballet taskmasters, and they didn't learn jazz or Latin or modern or any of these other things. What is the training like of your dancers today?
Well, we look for, when we hire a dancer, we look for a dancer who obviously has a strong classical technique. That's number one, and all the women dance on point. They were all trained classically. And then we look for someone who maybe has had other forms of dance, but mainly we look for someone with an open mind, someone that is, you know, open to new experiences and that it gets excited about working with another choreographer. And then really on top of that, it's really just the interaction with the choreographer that has shaped our dancers' techniques. Over the course of the 14 years, the wide range of choreographers that they have worked with has really shaped who they are as a company. And we found that each time a choreographer comes in, the company looks a little bit different. And we had the same thing now with our newest choreographer, Caetano Soto. The company is different now. Because they've worked with him.
Because they've absorbed and internalized the poetry of that.
Yeah, exactly. But we do, every morning we do a ballet class. It's very simple. It's not like what you're talking about, strict Russian technique, anything like that, but it is a ballet class. The women dance on point. And we do that every morning. And we keep it simple. We do try to make it a little bit more therapeutic. Considering the repertoire that they have to do, maybe more stretches. There's some yoga incorporated into it. All the dancers cross-train. Some of the dancers are rock climbers or yoga or different things that they do during the layoffs and things. But much like the repertoire, they're very versatile in what they do.
And probably coffee and cigarettes aren't as much of it part of it as they used to be.
Well, not cigarettes, but I think coffee is.
We're talking to Tom Mossbrooker of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. Dancers are training in the ways that you're talking about, but then there is also, as you say, the open-minded part of it, whereby they have to understand the poetry and the meanings and the subtleties that are inherent in whatever the choreographer's vision might be. Or is that their job?
Yes, it is their job, but you're right. They have to have a creative mind and an openness and an honesty. I find a tremendous honesty within when I watch the performance of a company. I just think that we're lucky the dancers are open and honest and creative, and I think that makes, it really makes an impact on the audience. It's what the look of the company is.
And what's interesting when you say that, you think, well, what's a dishonest dancer?
Yeah, exactly. But I think someone maybe that's just going through the motions, or maybe putting on something extra that's not really there, or I don't know. I know that there's something special when I look at the company, and I think maybe I'm not objective. But.
How do you actually go about choosing the choreographers? I mean, obviously, if you're commissioning works, you don't even know what you're getting before you get into it.
Right. Well, we usually know, become familiar with the choreographer's work, unless it's a brand new choreographer, Caetano Soto. We'd only seen just a few snippets of his work when we commissioned him the first time. Actually, the first work that he did was not a commission. It was called Fugaz. And we really enjoyed working with him. We liked the way he interacted with the dancers. And it was really that made us think, oh, we should commission him. We should take a chance on him, because we just felt there was something special there.
Now, his piece that people will see tomorrow night is called Uneven.
Correct.
Tell us about that piece.
It's called Uneven. And he said that it was the way he was feeling. He hit very big, very fast. Not really in the States, but in Europe. He's been choreographing for the past year and a half, almost nonstop.
And he's young. He's in his 30s.
Young, in his 30s, yeah. And he said that he would wake up in the morning, he didn't know what city he was in. And he just felt off kilter and off balance and just generally uneven. And so when he came to Aspen, it was the last commission that he had to do, and he said he just wanted to release all of those feelings of unevenness and imbalance, and he didn't do any unison work. He said he only wanted to do pas de deux. He used all the men and only three of the women, and it's just it's mainly all pas de deux, and there's never a point when all eight dancers are on stage at once. So it's very unusual in that way, but it was, again, what he was feeling at the time, unbalance and unevenness.
And I think one of the strengths of that work, I took it in very deeply when it was being performed, or it felt that way at the time, is that that kind of unevenness that he felt in his life is reflective of states that I think maybe very many of us feel in our lives, which are so unpredictable and often chaotic, and even if our personal lives aren't, our larger society is.
Yeah, and in the duet work, you see so much of it looks dysfunctional or awkward, or and the two people interacting, and that's very much like
relationships
like it is in relationships
today. Well, and I think that's one of the things that's so beautiful about dance is that, you know, the pas de deux, the man and the woman in their traditional form doing things that are beautiful, but on some level predictable in a very pleasant way, represents a kind of social structure that has fallen apart.
Exactly. Yeah. It's great to have both. You know, it's great to see both sides of it. The dancers loved working with him. It was very interactive. They had a lot of input in the creation of it, which was really terrific for them as dancers.
And there was a live cellist on the stage, and there will be tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. Kimberly Patterson is going to be playing the cello live. We originally wanted to have live music for the premiere, and when we loved it so much, it became such an important part of the work that we said we're going to really try to have her every time we perform the work. We're going to be doing that work in New York City at the Joyce this February, and she'll be playing with us.
So do you do a lot of touring?
We do a lot of touring. We did 35 cities last year. The year before, we did 45 cities. But as I said, this year is our 15th anniversary, and we've cut way back on our touring, and we're going to put all our focus in our home communities of Aspen and Santa Fe. We're going to be creating work. We're going to be, we've expanded our season here. We're going to be doing more of these encore performances, have some more presentations than we had last year. We just want to sort of concentrate on home and celebrate our 15th anniversary.
Talk for a moment about Niccolò Fonte.
Niccolò is one of the first choreographers that really had an impact on the company in many ways. He was the first choreographer to introduce this sort of contemporary work that we do. If anyone would be a resident choreographer, it would be him. He's really defined the look of the company. Back in 1999, he sent us a video of his work, and there was a ballet called In Hidden Seconds on the video. It was a stunning ballet for 10 dancers, and at the time we only had 8. We fell in love with the ballet. We said, oh my gosh, it's incredible. We could never do that ballet. We would never be good enough to do it. But let's call him and see if he would create something for us. So he did, and the rest is history. He's done 7 works for us, created 6 works for us, and then finally last year we said, well, what about that ballet we saw way back when?
In Hidden Seconds.
Yeah.
And so that's the one that we're going to see tomorrow.
That's the one. And he said, oh, I think it would be beautiful in the company. And we did, you know, I'm glad we waited because it was really the right time.
And in that ballet, the backdrop is a kind of interactive moving part of the dance.
It's constructed of elastic bands that you don't see, that they come in and out of, so they disappear into the background, and then later on in the piece it's lit from behind, and whenever they open the light comes shooting through.
But it's so cool.
It's great. And the music is John Tavener, and just the most glorious music. He was really inspired by his yoga practice when he created that work. And a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. And then a lot of other people say, oh, I don't see that at all.
Huh.
But it's interesting because he said it was the moment between your breath, the hidden second as you're exhaling and inhaling, of that quiet stillness. And that's what inspired him for that.
Very interesting. It also had a very contemporary feeling, maybe different from the Caetano Soto, but also some of the psychology of our time that I can't even put words to right now somehow is expressed in that piece.
Yeah, I love that piece. It uses all 10 dancers. It's sort of there's a real sense of community, and anytime you see the entire company on stage, you kind of like, it has a bigger impact because you see the full Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, and every dancer is in this piece. And you know, there's unison work, there's pas de deux, there's pas de trois. Everyone is used in a different way. Each couple has sort of a different, you know, dynamic to it. And I don't know, I just think it's a really good fit for us.
Now, you were talking, before we went on the air, we were talking about how in the New York City Ballet, you had George Balanchine, who had a couple of his favorite dancers, and he would choreograph pieces specifically for them, and then when somebody else did it, it would kind of change a little bit. How does that work in your company? Are choreographers working with choreography for specific people?
Yeah, very much in the same way. Because we haven't had a lot of turnover in the company, our dancers have been with us for one. Seth has been with us for 15 years, and you know, 13 after that, and then another dancer for 8 years, 9 years. So when the choreographers come back, which we like to always bring them back, they really know the company. They know who they want to use and what they want to do with them even before they arrive. And usually, it's not that case. When a choreographer comes, they have to get to know the company.
Yeah.
They usually a choreographer in a bigger company, they'll come and they'll work for a week or two just getting to know the company and casting who they want to use. But we bypass that step completely because they know exactly what they want to do when they arrive.
Well, and it's also interesting when you have a company where there's not so much turnover, then you have dancers who are getting older, who are more mature,
yeah.
who maybe will come upon some injuries or physical limitations, but also coming across a greater mastery in dance.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what has been really rewarding for us, is to be able to see the development of those dancers. You know, dancers like Seth and Sam and Katie and Samantha, who've been with us for so long. To see them and look back 5 years, how they were and what they're like now, it's really great, very rewarding.
What is the life cycle, so to speak, of a dance career at this point in a company like yours?
It varies. You know, dancers can dance for a very long time, and we don't encourage them to dance as long as they possibly can. We encourage them to be as fulfilled as they can possibly be, and then plan for the future and have a nice long transition, be prepared for the next step. We've had dancers that retired in their 20s. We had a woman that recently retired in her 30s, and she's almost now completed her nursing school, but she really planned everything. A lot of our dancers have been continuing their education while they're with us, and so we sort of encourage them to be smart about the transition and know that it's coming, and not just look blindly forward like I did.
Yeah, but here you are, artistic director of a company.
Yeah, that's true. Well, not everyone gets to be as lucky as me.
What? Tell us about your own background.
Well, I was a dancer for many years with the Joffrey Ballet. I danced there for 20 years. And then I had this wonderful opportunity to start a company out in Colorado.
And so you went straight from the Joffrey to this,
correct,
to Aspen
Santa Fe
Ballet.
Correct, straight from the Joffrey. The Joffrey was based for many years in New York City, and there was a big transition period where they moved to Chicago. And it was that same period that I moved to Aspen, Colorado with Jean-Philippe, and we started the company.
That's a big transition in the sense that I imagine that when you're a dancer at a major company like the Joffrey or whatever, on some level your life is kind of planned out for you.
Yeah.
And when you start a company, you have to do everything from scratch.
Yeah, completely different. What the great thing about Jean-Philippe and myself, we... Early on, we knew that we had no idea how to run a company. We had no desire to run a company. We only knew a dancer's point of view because we were young at the time. And so everything that we did, we just approached it from a dancer's point of view. When you're a dancer, you know, in a big company, you complain all the time. Why don't they do it this way? Why don't we do it that way? And so finally we said, well, here's our chance to do it the way we want to do it. And
did you? All
did.
The things that you complained about before, did
we
you
did.
Correct those?
We did. I feel like we did a lot of the things. I mean, I look back now and say, oh, now I understand this, now I understand that, you know, things like that. But we really did approach it from a dancer's point of view, and we really kind of had the motto of, like, dancer first. First, it's about the dancer, and then everything else. And we still, you know, have that in our philosophy, and I think it's been good. It's served us well.
How do you do things differently when you're doing it from the dancer's point of view? Like, what are some of the complaints that you had when you were a company member, and presumably your dancers aren't having those same complaints?
Well, you know, certain things like payment, you know, we want to pay our dancers fairly. I would rather pay a dancer than, you know, hire another staff member. I would. Usually it's the opposite in the larger companies. Also, the way you treat the dancers in the studio, that's a big part of it. In the bigger companies, you tend to be treated more, I don't know, not as respectfully. You're treated like a, you know, a tiny part of a big puzzle. And in this company, we treat them each like, you know, a big piece of a small puzzle. I encourage them to be creative, which is not the case in larger companies. You're not encouraged to be creative. You're encouraged to be consistent. You know, they want you to do it exactly the same way every night. Well, I want them to be creative every night. And if it looks a little bit different, you know, tomorrow night than it did in July, if maybe something else came out, you know, expression came out that didn't come out in July, then I'm happy about it because it's fresh. Things like that.
The New York City, which is really my, I keep mentioning this, is my only point of reference for a professional ballet company that I know well. One thing that was so striking about it when I was watching those ballets in the 70s and 80s was that the dancers were chosen to all be exactly, especially the women, exactly the same size and the same body. So that they were almost, I mean, replicas of each other, both in the way they moved and in the way they looked. And you almost can't do a Balanchine ballet without that. But nobody's doing that anymore.
Well, it was ingenious what he did, because when you look at like something like Swan Lake, where you had like 50 swans that look exactly alike, and you know, and then he did it, but without the sets and without the costumes, and we had 50 girls in tiny little, you know, black leotards and clean stage design, nothing, no sets, white floor and a white backdrop. It was incredible what he did, you know. But you're right, you know.
But at the same time, then the dancers' autonomy, I can't even imagine what it was like to be a member of that company.
Yeah, exactly.
But their autonomy and creativity is...
But then look what he did for the soloists and the principals. I mean, he really capitalized on their personalities, like someone like Suzanne Farrell and Edward Villela. I mean, it was all about who they were and their personalities. It was incredible.
We're talking to Tom Mossbrooker of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. We haven't talked much about Jorma Elo, who is doing the third ballet. Tell us about this choreographer.
Jorma Elo is someone that we were aware of for many, many years. I knew of him as a dancer with Netherlands Dance Theater under Yuri Killian. And I had heard through friends that Jorma was becoming interested in choreography. This was really when we only about 3 or 4 years into having started the company. And we said, oh, wouldn't that be great if we could have him come out and do a work for us? But we weren't prepared at the time. We didn't have the great dancers that we have now. We didn't have the means to hire a foreign choreographer. There's lots of red tape involved with immigration and visas and things like that. But we were aware of him. And a few years later, we said, well, what about Jorma Elo? Maybe we should bring him in. And finally, we did. He was very open to coming. He was really excited. And right about the same time, he got the job as resident choreographer for the Boston Ballet. And so it was right after that he just hit it huge in the States, and suddenly every large ballet company, from New York City Ballet to San Francisco Ballet, Pacific Northwest Ballet, American Ballet Theatre, all had to have a work by Jorma Elo. Luckily, we also had a work by him, and so he's remained...
This current one?
No. This was a work called Point Off. I guess it was maybe 6 years ago that we did it. And so we were very lucky to get in early on. If we had missed it by maybe 6 months, he would have been too busy with the bigger company.
Interesting.
And he, you know, we hit it off with him. He loved working with the company. He loved working in a small, nurturing environment. And I think it's rewarding for the choreographer as well to work in that way. And so he stayed very connected to the company. We asked him back two more times, and again this year he's going to be doing a fourth work for us. So in that way it's been great. We've developed a great relationship with him.
And this one, Red Suite, is when I have it in my memory, I don't remember it as well as the other two, but it seemed like a lot of very colorful lighting and a sort of candy feeling.
Yeah, it is. It's very colorful, pink and purple and fuchsia, and it's also humorous to it. A lot of the contemporary, you think of contemporary work, you think of very dark and serious and emotional, and his is witty and light.
Yeah.
The dancers, you can see the relationship they have with each other. We just performed at the Kennedy Center.
Really?
Yeah, it was great. We were part of Ballet Across America.
Wow.
And we shared the stage with the Joffrey Ballet, Tulsa Ballet, and Aspen Finale.
So you really have a national reputation now.
We do.
When you perform in Aspen, do you have a theater that's comparable to the Lenzic?
No, unfortunately, we don't. We're very lucky to be able to perform at the Lenzic. It's really one of the most beautiful theaters that we perform in. It feels very much like home. They've been very welcoming to us. I wish we did have something like that.
And but I guess the floor is one of the most important things.
The floor, but just also there's such a beautiful sort of atmosphere at the Lansing. The yeah. theater itself has a charisma to it. You know, people enjoy. I remember when we were performing in Santa Fe before the Lansing, when the Lansing opened, it just changed everything. I feel people are happy. People love going to the theater.
It's such a huge, when you think about things that have made our city what it is, the Lansing really is a huge part of it.
I think it's a huge part. I think it made a big impact on all the arts groups.
So when you have a piece by one of the choreographers, like the ones we've been talking about, and the choreographer comes, creates the piece, works with the dancers, you learn it, okay, then a year, 2, 3 years later, you start all over again with that piece to perform it somewhere else, the choreographer's not there. How do you get that feeling back with that piece?
Well, first of all, we only usually license a ballet for 2 to 3 years. So after 3 years, we're not...
We can't just use it. Yeah.
So we would have to contact the choreographer again and say, Yorma, could we please do this piece again? Hopefully he would say, yes, I would love it. If it's pretty much the same casting, we would probably put it together ourselves, but then we would always have to bring the choreographer back for final approval and to look at it. And it's really
so they
great.
Really do stay involved.
They really do, and we try to keep them involved as much as possible. I think, especially with mixed repertoire like we have, it's important that each piece looks different from one to the other. And so when you bring the choreographer back, it tends to really make that distinction.
Do you do any dancing of your own these days?
No, I don't. People ask me that all the time.
Do you even go out dancing or?
No, not so much.
Yeah.
No, and people always say, do you miss dancing?
Yeah.
No. I really don't. I feel I danced for a really long time. I loved it. I really got my fill of it. It's not easy.
And I think you lose so much so quickly once you stop.
Yeah, you do. I guess if I miss anything, I miss that feeling of, you know, the body, the total body, feeling in shape.
Do you stay in shape in other ways?
Oh, I try. But I feel I love working with the dancers in the studio. And I love watching them perform on stage. It's really, I kind of get the same feeling as I had when I was dancing, that rewarding feeling of watching someone else do it and helping them, and, you know, helping them be creative.
What actually is your job as artistic director?
Artistic director, Jean-Philippe is the executive director. I'm the artistic director, although the lines are very blurred. We both hire the dancers together, which is unusual. We pick the repertoire together. I do all the rehearsing with the dancers in the company. I do all the work on stage, all the staging. I do all the interaction with the choreographers. But the lines are a little bit blurry.
Tom Mosbrooker is the artistic director of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. And once again, the encore of the performance that they did earlier this year is happening tomorrow night, Friday the 22nd of October at 7:30 at the Lensic. Now, this is the 15th anniversary of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. Do you want to give us a little preview of what's coming up in Santa Fe this year?
Yeah, we have a lot of great things happening. In November, we have Jigu Thunder Drums of China, which is a great family show. It's fantastic.
Thunder Drums of China.
Live music, live drumming, Chinese dudes. Going to be incredible. And then, of course, the Nutcracker in December. We're bringing Ailey 2 in February. We're bringing...
Alvin Ailey.
Their second company. Yeah, they've been here before. It's a terrific, terrific company. That's on February
5th. Do they
5th.
Work with your dancers?
No. This is part of our presentation series.
Yeah.
And then Aspen Santa Fe Ballet again, March 11th and 12th. We have a brand new repertoire program, mixed repertoire program, a new piece by Niccolo Fonte.
Oh, nice.
A new Killian piece. Not new, but new to us. And then we finished the winter season with Nitrogram, the Indian dance from India.
I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And for more information for tickets for tomorrow night, people can call 505-988-1234. And they can also go to AspenSantaFeBallet.com. Just great to have you back on the radio.
Oh, thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome Alina Scheim. She is the Executive Director of Impact Personal Safety. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So Impact Personal Safety is an organization that's been around for a while, and we've talked to various people from it. You've now been there for a couple of years, and it's changed a little bit over the years. What is Impact all about, first of all?
Well, Impact's mission is we're a nonprofit, and we empower children and adults by teaching them to prevent and defend themselves against verbal, physical, and sexual violence. And I've been involved with the organization for about 6 years since I took my first class. And in the past couple of years, we've been expanding to better work with the schools. One of the pieces that we've always been doing has been this experiential self-defense class that covers all aspects of self-defense, awareness, verbal, and physical. And one of the pieces that we've expanded to do just a little bit more deliberately is work with the schools so that we can really be working in prevention. Because we know that as lovely as our courses have always been, doing a four-hour course with a school is very difficult when they're limited in time, money, how many students can fit into a classroom and how that works with experiential classes. And so we've really done expansion of our classes under that same mission, but with an ability to really better address schools' needs.
There have been a number of cases that have made it into the newspaper, and probably many more that haven't in recent years, where a little girl or a little boy going to school is in real danger of being abducted, defends him or herself, runs away, whips their hand away, whatever it takes, goes to school. Of course, it's traumatic for them, but they didn't get abducted. And this has, to me, the imprint of Impact Personal Safety on it.
Mm-hmm. The Center for Missing and Exploited Children, there was a study that was recently published in the Washington Post not more than 2 months ago, and they actually did a study of attempted and completed child abductions by strangers, which is very much the minority of the kinds of abductions that happen with children. And they actually found that nationally, it's just a little over 100 children are abducted a year. And that's
by strangers.
And so that's a really interesting statistic to me with the amount of fear that we have of strangers in this culture.
Yeah.
And to then look at, you know, this is one of the very least things that you should be afraid of as a parent or as a concerned adult. The other piece that they showed, actually, the headline of that article was children are their best defense. They're their own best defense. Because in the vast majority of cases, the children were actually able to stop what had happened by screaming, by getting somebody else's attention, and very rarely by any sort of physical technique. Usually it was one of the other things, and the person went running.
In those rare cases, and we don't want to dwell on them because they are such a minority, but in Santa Fe, had those children been through the Impact courses?
The one that had, one that actually didn't make the news so much had taken the class as a 7-year-old, and she was in the park with her babysitter, and her babysitter was a little distance away, and a man tried to abduct her. He tried to pick her up, and she immediately started screaming and knocked him with her scooter, and he immediately dropped her and went running away. She didn't have to do hardly anything. The babysitter came, they made a police report, and it was interesting to talk with the parents who obviously had signed her up for this children's class with us a while back, said it was harder for them than it was for her. And for the way that the dad described it, which I thought was really great, is he described it as a near miss. It was like driving down the street and, you know, you almost get in a car accident. And you think about it, you know, you think about it for a day or so. You might tell your friends what happened, but it's not that accident that could affect your life forever. And so that's what we want for our kids. We want those near misses if something's going to happen.
And as we've discussed with Impact people in the past, when you, as the potential victim, actually do the action that saves yourself and nothing really happens to you, you have the kind of psychological reaction of having won.
Mm-hmm.
And when you feel that you've won, you're not nearly as traumatized, if at all.
Right. You have that different story. One of the pieces, you know, brain science is getting very, very popular these days. And one of the pieces that we've been looking at is there's brain science that talks about trauma nowadays. And trauma happens when you're adrenalized, when there's an experience of fear or danger, and you feel powerless and helpless. And naturally, it gets into the body in this very deep level that can take years to resolve. And we know it can affect all aspects of your life. And now, the same thing is actually true if you're adrenalized and have a successful experience, whether it's a simulated experience in our class or in real life, where you have that successful experience. Because of that adrenaline, it goes in just as deep. So that's actually, I love that science, because when I teach classes and I see the transformation in students and I hear the stories afterwards of them suddenly, you know, changing their job situation and all these things that aren't really technically related to self-defense, it's interesting to see, oh, it's because of that deep sense of empowerment, just like the way trauma can be that deep. If the empowerment is that deep, it can have just as huge effects. So that success in real life is amazing.
So basically, in a situation where you're adrenalized and you win, mm-hmm. that produces a kind of sense of empowerment that filters out into other areas of your life.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So how do the different courses work? You do the course that I did years ago after, in my case, sort of semi-traumatic incident myself, was, what it was, 20 hours. It went over a couple of weekends, and it was heavy duty. I mean, you have to basically learn modified martial arts moves and hit a man wearing a padded outfit so that you don't actually hurt the guy, but hit him as hard as you can in all these different ways. Tell us more about, I mean, that's a thumbnail, but tell us more about that course.
So we are now calling those courses experiential courses because you have the experience of actually taking care of yourself in a threatening or dangerous moment. And so in that course, we have someone like me who teaches the class, who leads the majority of the information that students are going to learn, demos it, and then walk students through the step-by-step skills that then they practice in scenarios that I then coach them through. I'm there the whole time. And then we have another instructor who does a lot of what I do, as well as plays the role of either somebody crossing a verbal boundary or somebody actually physically assaulting them. And what we do is, as you said, they're in this padded suit, they're in this padded armor, so that they're protected physically so that students can hit full force. And they're also trained to recreate common threatening and assault situations. So what's great about that is there's been years and years of research that have gone into the techniques that will actually make an assailant leave verbally after a verbal defense or be hurt or leave physically. And so they don't go away unless... That's one of the things that I hear people say is when they see a graduation and they see a video is, oh, well, he's just letting go. They don't let go unless you actually make them let go, which I think is great because a lot of us have never had the experience of needing to defend ourselves verbally or physically or haven't done it in a way that we felt good about afterwards. And so to have that experience that all this research has gone into of, oh, this is exactly what I need. This is what I need, and it will be effective. Or, you know, I'll use this strategy, and if this doesn't work, I'll use this strategy. There's a plan. It's not this lingering what-if question that I think follows a lot of people around every day. It's, oh, if this happened, I could do this, or this, or this, and I know that.
And having that as a tool at your disposal makes one... I've often wondered what it would be like, I mean, for me as a woman, what would it be like to be a 6'4", 250-pound strong man walking around in my skin in the world. And you're not going to get that from impact as a fairly small woman or somebody who's not that strong, but you get something more than what you came in with.
And one of the pieces, it's interesting that you say that because we're actually teaching our Personal Safety 101, which is a one-hour seminar that we're able to do for any group at no cost. And we're teaching that for the entire Española school district.
Wow.
For all of their teachers and all of their middle school and high school students. And what's interesting about that is actually the experience of teaching men, and sometimes men that you know, for someone who's a smaller woman, our experience is rather different around safety. But to talk with the young men, especially in those classes, who are suddenly going from children to being these feared people, or to those people that suddenly, you know, one of the pieces we talk about is making eye contact as a way of showing people that you're confident as you walk down the road to avoid being perceived as an easy target. What's interesting for a lot of those people that fit kind of a different category than I would, for example, is that they have to think about, okay, I need to make eye contact, but I can't make too much eye contact because if I do, people will perceive it as a challenge.
Right.
And then suddenly I have to talk my way out of a fight.
Right.
Or what, you know, and I say fight in quotation marks because really, you know, I think that this is this piece that there's so much violence in our communities, and we talk about fights as though both people want to be there. And the fact is that most of the time, one person doesn't want to be there. And I like to compare it to sexual assault and rape because if, you know, if in sex, one person doesn't want to be there, it's now sexual assault or rape. If in a fight, one person doesn't want to be there, it's not a fight that two people have agreed to. It's a physical assault.
It's assault, yeah.
And we need to treat it like that for our young people and for our men because the fact is that, interestingly, forcible rape is only 6% of violent crimes in the United States. 60% is actually physical assault. And so this is a huge issue that, you know, I got into this work because of women. I as a woman, had my own experiences before the class that made me want to take the class in the first place. And I was working at Esperanza Shelter before I came to Impact. But it's very interesting as I do the work more to hear all these men going, we need this.
Yeah.
We need this. Just because I'm big doesn't mean I'm not facing other things.
So what are some of the other programs that you offer for the community?
So we have basically the experiential class structure, and we have a 4-hour class for teens and adults, 20 hours like you took, and then a 6-hour class for children, 6 to 12.
Now, the 6-hour class for children 6 to 12 happens over a number of days.
Yeah, it's usually over 2 days, broken up into 3-hour segments so that we can reinforce the concepts and teach different concepts. Exactly. And it's very, very different than our teen and adult classes. I think that's important to emphasize, that we don't talk about scary things with children. You don't need to. You can teach them these concepts without having to talk about the bad things in the world just to stay safe. And then we have our seminar structure, which is an hour long. And they're basically formed through conversations with the school district, with Santa Fe Public Schools, as well as the fact that I came from Esperanza, where the same people that I was helping a few days before, once I got to Impact, you know, I had to face the fact that if someone had been assaulted the night before or had just left their spouse that was abusing them, it's not a good idea for them to be in a recreated assault situation a week later.
Right.
And so it was heartbreaking for me to have to turn them away, even though I was referring them to Esperanza and referring them to Rape Crisis, which is now Solace. So it was very exciting for me to come to this realization of, oh, by doing these 1-hour segments, we can work with people who have small amounts of time, like the schools, a lot better. And we can help people who maybe wouldn't be ready for the experiential class, but need something to help shift their perspective and to start feeling stronger.
So in a seminar situation, it's basically talk and demonstration?
Mm-hmm. And as well as interactive pieces for them. So in our Personal Safety 101, we teach basically what an assailant is looking for and how to avoid being that target statistically by teaching awareness skills, body language. So for people who have taken the class, that's the awareness stance and ready stance, as well as how to use one's voice to prevent or stop an assault. There's also a small segment of media literacy that we do in that class because the fact is, even if somebody hasn't experienced violence in the past, we've seen so many images in the media and on the news where it looks like if somebody tries to target you, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's good for people to start seeing images and start seeing it so that it's actually possible. We actually talked with a woman who, after one of those sessions, someone broke into her house. And she was surprised and upset about it, but she immediately went into the ready stance that she'd learned in the class and used a very strong, assertive voice to tell him to leave, and he left.
Wow.
And so that was
good timing.
Yeah, it was great. I was so pleased that we could do that. And it's astounding for those of us who have done the 20-hour program to think just in 1 hour to think that it's possible to do this will make it more likely that someone will actually take care of themselves in the way they need to.
We're talking to Alina Scheim of Impact Personal Safety. One of the seminars that you teach is called Motivations of Violence. And I've been thinking about that because just yesterday, the day before, we had Richard Rhodes on the air talking about the history of the atomic bomb and how at the very, very end of the book, he talks about how violence is rooted in a kind of profound helplessness. Hmm. And I wondered, and I've just been thinking about that because when you think about the level of violence inherent in not even nuclear war, but any war or any kind of mass brutality. It's almost inconceivable to people who have never been through that. What do you teach in Motivations of Violence?
What we teach is the relationship between power and violence and oppression and violence. And so if we look at, you know, there's obviously hate crime legislation that has made a widespread impact across the United States. But if you look at all violent crime, generally there is some sort of peace that we talk about in the social justice movement, at least, around race, class, gender, sexuality. And so, you know, oftentimes the news media will talk about random acts of violence, but the fact is it's not usually random. It's usually based in one of these factors, which is really related to what the person you interviewed the other day talked about is, you know, if somebody feels helpless, which I think we all do at some point or another, they're going to try to get one up on another person. It's just natural. It's a way of finding power. If you can't find power within yourself, you try to find it in power in the social structure. And there's this awful and great resource, as far as social structure goes, that already exists that says these people are above other people, these people are lesser than. And so if you can start, you know, the ways that we see that in schools is by people using language as a way of hurting other people. You know, we have bullying, we have specifically gay bullying. You know, there's all these pieces that, you know, I just taught with the Gay Straight Alliance the other week. I taught this curriculum, and I asked them, what do you do when somebody says gay or fag in an insulting way, as a way of insulting someone? And I expected that they would say, oh, well, I tell them how hurt I feel or how offended I am because I'm gay or because my friend's gay. And they said, oh, it's not a big deal. I don't do anything. And it's interesting because these are kids who right now are very upset, very concerned about the suicides that have been happening and about the, you know, about the right to marry and all these pieces.
And, you know, I have to say, Dan Savage, who has a syndicated column that mm-hmm. is in The Reporter, among many other places, has been doing a wonderful job on that, mm-hmm. covering that issue.
Mm-hmm. And I think so many, I just came from the Coordinated Community Response Council meeting, and, you know, their focus was on this at this quarterly meeting. And there's so many people who are looking at it and really concerned and really compassionate, and I love that. It's great to see.
Now, what is the psychology of people who are bullying gay people? Okay, so it's the gay teenage boy, let's say, who is the powerless one in the situation. What's the psychology of the person who's bullying the powerless kid?
Well, I think an important piece, we're working actually a lot more with the juvenile justice system and people either who have offended or are at risk of offending. And I think it's really important to work with them because if you start working with them, you realize 99.9% of them have already been assaulted themselves or been abused themselves. And so if you look at that, they're trying to heal from that. And unfortunately, violence is a very misguided way of trying to heal from that. Insulting others is a very misguided way of trying to somehow feel whole yourself again.
But that is the underlying mechanism that's going on in their minds.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's very tricky. It's very hard to feel that compassion and also hold them accountable at the same time. And I think that's our task as a community. And why we're working with them specifically is to help them understand what they're doing, but also to help them feel safe again so they don't have to do that in order to feel safe.
Alina Scheim is the executive director of Impact Personal Safety. She's also an instructor. Just quickly, what classes do you have coming up that people might want to sign up for?
For the public, we have a women's basics class, which is the one you took. That will be the first 2 weekends of November, Saturdays and Sundays. We'll have a four-hour class in January for teens and adults, as well as a kids class in January for teens and adults. And we also will have that Personal Safety 101, the free class, at the Genevieve Chavez Center, I think at the end of the month. I'm not the one teaching it, but I think it's at the end of the month, and you can call them for info.
And for more information about classes, you can call 505-992-8833. You can also look at impactpersonalsafety.org, and you can also find them on Facebook. So, Alina, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.